Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious, Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Katra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are tackling, well, maybe one of the biggest questions there is. Are we truly free? Are we the pilots of our own lives? Or is something else, something predetermined, pulling the strings?
It's a huge one. We're diving into Robert Caine's major anthology, Free Will. And this isn't just a single perspective. It's like a map of the entire battlefield of ideas on this topic. Philosophy, science, law. It's all in there.
Absolutely. And look, this isn't just some dusty philosophical puzzle. It hits right at the core of, well, everything. How we run society, how we think about right and wrong.
How we assign blame or praise, even how we feel about our own successes and failures. You know, that gut feeling most of us have, I chose this. I could have done differently.
Mm-hmm.
But then science comes along, talking about cause and effect, chains of events stretching back, well, forever. If everything is caused, where does genuine choice actually fit in? It feels like a direct clash. It really does.
Yeah.
And that's the tightrope the book walks. Caine's goal here is to lay out that conflict clearly, our deep intuition of freedom versus the scientific picture of a determined universe. He brings all the major players to the table.
Okay, so let's talk about the guide for this journey, Robert Caine himself. Because he's not just the editor putting the book together, right? He's a central figure in this whole debate.
Oh, absolutely. Professor Robert Caine, he's emeritus at the University of Texas at Austin, spent over 40 years deep in this stuff. He's seen the argument shift, especially with, you know, modern brain science entering the picture.
And crucially, he has a horse in this race. He's not neutral. He's maybe the leading proponent of what's called libertarianism in this context. He argues passionately for free will.
Yes, he believes we have it. And that it requires the universe to be, at some fundamental level, not fully determined. Indeterminacy is key for him.
His own big idea is the self-forming actions theory, or SFAs. We'll definitely unpack that later.
We will. But what's really impressive and makes this anthology so valuable is his fairness. Even though he has a strong position, he gives, like, prime real estate to the arguments against his view. Compatibilists, hard determinists, they get a full, powerful hearing.
That takes real intellectual confidence, doesn't it? To showcase your opponent's best arguments.
It does. It speaks volumes. You know, his own book, The Significance of Free Will, back in 96, really cemented his place.
Yeah.
And it gave him the standing to structure this whole complex, messy debate for us in this collection.
Okay, so let's get an overview of the book itself. How does Caine structure this huge debate?
He organizes it around what's often called the Great Trilemma. Basically, three main camps, three possible ways things could be. If you grasp these three, you've got the main landscape.
Right. So camp number one.
That's compatibilism. These are the thinkers who say, hold on, maybe free will and determinism aren't enemies. They think the two can coexist, maybe even require each other. It often involves redefining what we mean by free.
Okay, so they're trying to find a harmony. What's camp two?
Incompatibilism. These guys say, nope, harmony is impossible. You have to choose.
Mm.
But this camp splits.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, one branch is libertarianism, that's Caine's camp. Yeah. They say free will is real, therefore determinism must be false. Genuine freedom wins out.
And the other branch of incompatibilism?
That's hard determinism, sometimes called skepticism. They take the other side of the coin. They say determinism looks pretty likely based on science.
Mm-hmm.
And since free will is incompatible with that, well, free will must be the illusion.
So compatibilists say yes to both. Libertarians say yes to free will, no to determinism. And hard determinists say yes to determinism, no to free will. Got it.
Exactly. And the book traces these ideas historically from ancient thinkers wrestling with fate all the way up to, you know, modern neuroscience and quantum mechanics. It covers the whole arc.
Let's dig into those arguments. Maybe start with the challenge to free will, the incompatibilist arguments. You mentioned Peter Van Inwagen.
Yes. His consequence argument is probably the most powerful modern argument against compatibilism. It's kind of the cornerstone for why many people think free will and determinism just can't mix.
Okay, break it down for us. How does it work?
It's actually quite intuitive, even if it sounds complex.
Hmm.
Think about any action you take, say, raising your hand right now.
Hey.
If determinism is true, that action is the necessary result of two things. The laws of nature and the state of the universe a long, long time ago, before you were born, even.
Right, like links in a chain stretching back.
Exactly. Now, you can't change the laws of nature, can you?
No, definitely not.
And you certainly can't change the state of the universe before you existed.
Nope.
So Van Inwagen argues, if your action is the necessary consequence of things you have absolutely no control over, then the action itself isn't truly up to you. It's just the inevitable outcome.
Wow. Yeah, I felt like that. It feels inescapable. Like my choice was already written.
That's the power of it. Mm-hmm. And the hard determinist, folks like Galen Strawson, build on this. Strawson has his basic argument. He says, look, to be truly morally responsible for what you do, you'd have to be responsible for the way you are, your character, your motivations, the stuff that leads to the action.
Makes sense.
But can you create yourself? Can you be the ultimate source of your own character? Strawson says, no, that's impossible. You can't pull yourself up by your own bootstraps from nothing, ex nihilo. So if you're not responsible for your character, you can't have that deep, ultimate moral responsibility for your actions either.
Okay, that's a pretty bleak picture from the incompatibilists. So how do the compatibilists fight back? They want to say free will within determinism.
They do. Their main move is usually to say the incompatibilists are aiming for the wrong kind of freedom. They say, look, freedom isn't about breaking the chains of causality. It's about acting without being, say, forced or constrained.
So like freedom from coercion, not freedom from causation.
Exactly. If you do what you want to do, based on your own beliefs and desires, without someone holding a gun to your head, then you acted freely, even if those beliefs and desires were themselves caused.
But the objection that immediately comes to mind is, if my desires were implanted in me by my upbringing or genetics, things I didn't choose, am I really free just because I'm acting on them? It still feels a bit puppet-like.
That's the classic objection. And compatibilists have developed more nuanced views. Take Harry Frankfurt's hierarchical compatibilism. It's clever.
Okay, how does that work?
He distinguishes between different levels of desire. You have first-order desires. I want that cookie.
Yeah.
But you might also have a second-order desire about that first desire. I wish I didn't want that cookie, maybe because you're on a diet.
Right. I have desires about my desires.
Precisely. Frankfurt says freedom, or what he calls free will, involves having your actions align with your second-order desires, the desires you endorse or want to have.
So the unwilling addict who takes the drug, first-order desire, but wishes they didn't want it, second-order desire, they act voluntarily but not freely in Frankfurt's sense.
Exactly. Their action doesn't align with the self they want to be. Freedom is about this kind of internal coherence, this ability to act on the desires you identify with.
That does add a layer of complexity. What about other compatibilist views?
Another big one is John Martin Fisher's reason-responsive view. He focuses less on desires and more on the decision-making process itself. He talks about guidance control.
Guidance control?
Yeah, the idea is that you're responsible if your decision-making, when it is in the way you deliberate and choose, is sensitive to reasons, particularly moral reasons. Huh. Even if, in that specific instance, you couldn't have actually done otherwise because determinism is true.
Okay. Unpack that a bit. Sensitive to reasons.
Think about someone driving recklessly versus someone whose brakes suddenly fail completely.
Yeah.
Both might hit something, but the reckless driver's decision process was capable of responding to reasons like, I should slow down, or there's a stop sign. They just chose not to. The person with brake failure, their mechanism couldn't respond to reasons in that moment. Fisher says only the first person has guidance control and is therefore responsible. It's about the capacity of the mechanism.
So responsibility lies in whether your mental machinery works properly, whether it could respond to reasons, even if the specific outcome was determined.
That's the core idea for Fisher. It tries to preserve responsibility without needing alternate possibilities.
Which brings us back full circle to Kane and the libertarians. They reject all this compatibilist footwork. They want genuine, undetermined choice. But how do they overcome that problem we mentioned? If it's undetermined, isn't it just random luck?
That is the central challenge for libertarians, the luck objection. And Kane's self-forming actions, SFAs, are his answer. He argues that true free will isn't exercised in every mundane choice, but in specific difficult moments.
Like major life decisions, moral dilemmas.
Exactly. Think of someone torn between a high-paying but morally dubious job and a lower-paying ethical one.
Mm.
Or staying in a safe but unfulfilling relationship versus taking a risk on the unknown. These are SFAs.
Okay, so what happens in those moments, according to Kane?
He suggests that in these moments of intense conflict, where you're genuinely pulled in different directions, there might be genuine indeterminacy at the neural level. Your brain is sort of buzzing with competing possibilities.
So like quantum effects or something bubbling up?
Potentially, yes.
Yeah.
The exact mechanism is debated, but the key point is the indeterminacy. Now, here's Kane's crucial move against the luck objection. He says because the person is effortfully willing both outcomes, they're trying hard to make the moral choice and trying hard to succeed financially, for example, Whichever way the indeterminacy resolves, the outcome flows from their effort and their character.
Ah, so the effort isn't random, even if the precise tipping point is.
Precisely. The agent's struggle, their willing effort, shapes the outcome. They are simultaneously trying to bring about both possibilities. When one wins, it's not random luck alien to the agent, it's the result of their internal struggle. And crucially, these SFAs shape the person's character going forward. You literally form yourself through these choices.
Okay, that's a complex but interesting way to try and ground undetermined choices in the agent's own efforts. But then science throws another wrench in the works, right? The Libet experiments.
Right. This is where neuroscience really enters the fray. Benjamin Libet's experiments from the 80s caused a huge stir.
What did he find?
He had people hooked up to EEG machines measuring brain activity. He told them to just flick their wrists whenever they felt the urge, and to note the exact moment they became consciously aware of that urge or intention.
Okay.
He found a specific brain signal called the readiness potential building up in the brain before the movement. But the shocking part was, this signal started, on average, several hundred milliseconds, like half a second, before the person reported consciously deciding to move.
Whoa. So the brain was getting ready to move before the person felt like they chose to move.
That was the interpretation that grabbed headlines. It seemed to suggest our conscious awareness of deciding is just late to the party. The unconscious brain makes the call, and our feeling of conscious will comes afterward, maybe like a rationalization.
Which sounds devastating for free will, especially the idea that I consciously initiate my actions.
It certainly looked that way to many. But the philosophical and scientific debate since then has been intense. The book covers this well.
What are the main counterarguments?
Well, a big one is questioning the task itself. Is spontaneously flicking your wrist really a good model for complex, reasoned decisions, like deciding who to marry or what career path to take? Those involve deliberation, values, not just an arbitrary urge.
Yeah, it seems like a very different kind of choice.
Right. Maybe the readiness potential just reflects the brain preparing for potential action or handling very simple, almost automatic movements without needing conscious deliberation up front. It doesn't necessarily rule out conscious control for more significant choices. The debate is far from over.
Okay, so moving from the specific arguments and experiments, what are some of the big overarching themes or messages that emerge from Kane's collection?
I think one major theme is the need for nuance regarding moral responsibility. Regardless of whether you're a compatibilist or an incompatibilist, the book pushes you toward seeing responsibility, not as a simple on-off switch, but as a gradient.
A spectrum.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
We need to consider things like a person's background, their mental state, the pressures they were under. It really encourages a more sophisticated, maybe more compassionate approach to judging others and ourselves. Less blame, more understanding, perhaps.
That makes sense. What else?
Another key theme is what you might call the pragmatic turn. Some contributors argue that, look, even if free will, in the deep metaphysical sense, turns out to be an illusion, the belief in free will might still be incredibly important, even necessary, for a functioning society.
How so?
Well, believing we are responsible agents seems to motivate ethical behavior. It underpins our legal systems. It encourages self-improvement. Think about it. What would happen if everyone suddenly became convinced that nobody is truly responsible for anything? It could be chaos. So the idea of free will has social utility, regardless of its ultimate truth.
That's a fascinating, kind of unsettling thought. That we might need a useful fiction.
It is. And tied to that is a third theme, the meaning and dignity argument. The whole debate forces us to ask fundamental questions about what gives human life value. Does our dignity depend on us being the ultimate uncaused causes of our actions?
Or can we find meaning and self-worth even if we accept that we are shaped by forces beyond our ultimate control?
Exactly. Can we find dignity in striving, in consciousness, in relationships, even within a determined framework? Or does something vital get lost if we give up on that idea of being the ultimate author? It's profoundly existential.
These are heavy themes. The book must have some memorable ways of phrasing these complex positions. Any standout quotes or core ideas that capture the essence?
Definitely. Kane himself provides a great starting point, defining the core libertarian quest. The problem of free will is the problem of whether we are truly responsible agents, the ultimate sources and authors of our actions. That phrase, ultimate sources and authors, really sets the high bar they're aiming for.
That's very clear. What about from the skeptical side?
Daniel Wegner, known for his work on conscious will, offers this challenge. The feeling of conscious will is not a direct perception of our causal efficacy, but rather an inference we make about our causal role based on various cues. Basically, he's saying that feeling of I did that isn't direct knowledge. It's your brain's best guess after the fact.
Oof, that undermines our subjective experience quite directly.
It does. And then, capturing the power of the incompatibilist challenge to compatibilism, you have an Inwagen's consequence argument, which we can paraphrase simply. If determinism is true, our actions are consequences of the laws of nature and the remote past. Therefore, the consequences of these things are not up to us. It's just so stark and intuitively compelling.
Those really crystallize the different stances.
So bringing this down to earth, how do these abstract philosophical arguments actually play out in the real world? What are the practical applications?
Well, one huge area is criminal justice reform. If you lean towards hard determinism or skepticism, believing true moral responsibility is impossible, then the whole idea of retributive justice starts to look shaky. Retribution meaning punishment purely because someone deserves it.
Exactly. If people couldn't have ultimately done otherwise, does it make moral sense to punish them just for desert? The focus shifts instead to more pragmatic goals, protecting the public, deterring future crime, and crucially, rehabilitation. Trying to fix the causes of the behavior rather than just inflicting pain. Think systems like Norway's, which are much more focused on rehabilitation.
That's a massive shift in perspective for justice systems like the US or UK.
Huge. And on a more personal level, it impacts relationships and forgiveness. If you internalize the idea that people's actions are heavily influenced, maybe even determined, by factors like their genetics, upbringing, past traumas, it can genuinely foster compassion.
Instead of immediate anger or blame when someone messes up.
You might shift towards curiosity. Mm-hmm. What led to this? What factors were at play? It doesn't mean condoning harmful behavior, but it changes the emotional response from pure condemnation toward understanding the underlying causes. It can make forgiveness, or at least acceptance, feel more possible.
And what about how we view ourselves?
That ties into self-compassion and growth. We often beat ourselves up for lacking willpower, right? Why can't I just stick to this diet? Or why did I procrastinate again? Understanding that our conscious will is maybe not the all-powerful force we imagine, and that behavior is shaped by habits, environment, unconscious factors.
Right.
It can lead to smarter strategies.
Like instead of just trying harder, maybe changing your environment to make the desired behavior easier?
Precisely. It shifts focus from blaming a weak will to intelligently designing your context, removing temptations, setting up better habits, understanding your triggers. It's often more effective than just gritting your teeth.
So wrapping this up, what's the final takeaway for you from diving into Kane's anthology? What's the most important thing to hold on to?
For me, it's appreciating the sheer complexity and realizing that agency, our ability to act, likely exists on a spectrum. It's not all or nothing. It's influenced by our biology, our history, our immediate situation. Recognizing this fosters, I think, both humility about our own limitations and a deeper appreciation for the moments where we do genuinely seem to reflect, deliberate, and make choices that shape who we become, those SFAs Kane talks about.
Yeah, I agree. My main takeaway is just how essential this question remains. It's not just an academic game. Grappling with free will forces us to examine the foundations of our legal system, our ethical beliefs, how we understand mental health, how we relate to each other. It's fundamental to living an examined life. King's collection doesn't necessarily give you the one answer, but it gives you all the tools you need to seriously engage with the question yourself. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.